Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Steve Quinn and Kim Dostal will be here to highlight youth hockey opportunities. We'll talk with producer Scott Burton about a new documentary featuring Tlingit art. We'll get a preview of a family concert this Friday by the Stringmans, and we'll have Juno School Student Services Director Bridget Weiss here to talk about the new Kinder Ready Preschool at Harborview School. Taking a look at the weather, expect rain that could be very heavy tonight at times, as well as tomorrow. It is possible that precipitation amounts could be between 3/4 and 1 inch both tonight and during the day tomorrow. Showers likely throughout the rest of the week. Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Community members in Fargo, North Dakota, gathered Monday to remember Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. The 22-year-old went missing for more than a week before her body was found Sunday in a river. She was 8 months pregnant when she disappeared. A newborn baby, believed to be Graywind's, was found alive last week. The Grand Forks Herald reports Monday's vigil included jingle dancers and a ceremony. Vigils were held Monday in tribal communities in North and South Dakota. Another public vigil is planned to take place at the North Dakota State Capitol Wednesday, as Native communities across the country plan to hold services to honor Graywind and all missing and murdered Indigenous women. Meanwhile, officials held a press conference Monday saying two people, William Hone and Brooke Cruz, face a number of charges in connection with Graywind's disappearance. In the town of Durham, New Hampshire, a mural depicting a Native American has sparked controversy. Jason Moon from New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
At issue is one image in the mural that was donated by local residents in the 1950s. It shows a Native American crouched behind a bush eyeing a colonial cabin. He's carrying a bow and arrows, and in one hand is a flaming torch. The image is titled Cruel Adversity. Some town residents and people of Native American heritage find the image derogatory. Kathleen Blake, a member of the New Hampshire Commission on Native American Affairs, says the image ignores the many acts of aggression committed by European settlers.
I mean, it could be the other way around. The cruel adversity could be the settlers in the garrison house rather than the Native people who already lived here.
Blake wants the image removed or covered. But others, including town councilor Feroz Kotrock, says the image is nothing residents should be ashamed of.
We should be taking pride in the Western civilization. We should be taking pride in our local history. And I don't think white men have anything to apologize for.
The Postal Service says it's against policy to remove artwork in post offices. They have offered to install interpretive text to accompany the mural. For now, the issue is on hold while the Commission on Native American Affairs decides whether they want to weigh in on the interpretive text or keep fighting for the mural's removal. For National Native News, I'm Jason Moon.
A South Dakota school has announced the naming of two locations on its campus in honor of Native Americans. As Jim Kent reports, Black Hills State University will recognize the well-known Lakota educators in a ceremony this fall.
Black Hills State University will designate the Jace DeCorey Center for American Indian Studies in recognition of the recently retired professor's research in the areas of American Indian women, elders, art, and traditional healing. The Lionel R. Bordeaux Library is named in recognition of the educator's academic and personal achievements. Bordeaux has served as president of Syntyguska University on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation since 1973, and is a 1964 graduate of BHSU. Black Hills State University President Tom Jackson Jr. says the school's location lends to its association with Native American cultures.
We feel a natural connection to the spirituality of the hills, and we believe as an institution we'll be the institutional caretaker for the Black Hills. So having a connection to the Native people of this region, it's just a natural extension of who we are as a university.
With the highest retention rate of Native students in South Dakota, Jackson notes that tribal members who attend BHSU stand a very positive chance of attaining their degrees. 5% of the student population at BHSU is Native and includes tribal members from South Dakota as well as Wyoming and Montana. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandlings, this afternoon's volunteer host, and on the board is our producer, Jeff Brown. Thank you, as always, Jeff. My first guests today on Juneau Afternoon are Steve Quinn. He is a hockey coach and a board member of the JD Ice Association, and Kim Dostal. She's a parent who's on the board as well and has three sons playing hockey. Steve, you're here, and so is Kim, to talk about a special thing that's happening this Saturday, one day, 2 hours, if I understand it correctly.
That's right. We call it our Discover Hockey, and it's for newcomers to the game who want to hop on the ice. We provide all the gear, and they get to skate around and play hockey with some of our younger players as well as the coaches. And last year, I think we had about 30 or 40 kids show up. They had a blast, and they stuck around for the season, most of them, and participated in our introductory program. And that program meets once a week on Saturdays. It starts in October, and it's Saturday morning. Usually, we've been doing it at 10:30 in the morning, and it's $99 a year, and we have gear that we essentially loan to the parents, and it's a $100 deposit for the gear, and they get 75 of it back when they return it. So basically, it's $25 gear rental for the year.
And when you say $99 a year, what's a season for these young girls and boys who would be getting involved in hockey? What would that Saturday morning commitment look like in terms of numbers of months or weeks?
I'm so glad you said girls and boys, because it is for girls and boys. And we have really good girl players, too, not just boy players. So to answer your question, every Saturday morning at 10:30, the newcomers hop on the ice with the coaches and some of the student coaches who are, like I said, they're players, they are in different skill levels, and they love working with the kids. They kind of think of it as giving back to the program that they've enjoyed all these years. And we just we do various drills to get them to be more comfortable and enjoy being on the ice with the skates and the stick and the puck. And we break them up into various groups, and they go from one station to the next to the next. And we have, toward the end of the year, we have games.
When you say end of the year, do you mean by December or thereabouts?
The season runs from October to the end of February for the introductory kids.
As opposed to the NHL, which just goes on
forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
It's like, you know, flowers are blooming and they're still on
they're
the ice.
They're still playing.
Kim, talk a little bit about what benefit you've seen for your three sons being involved with hockey.
Oh, it's just been so wonderful. The coaches here are just great. They've taught all of my boys about being a team player, the discipline, the hard work that's involved with a sport like this. I just can't say enough good things about what this provides for the boys. You know, they're in great shape. They don't realize how hard they're working because hockey is so fun. And they never say, oh, I don't want to go to hockey. That's the one sport that they just, no matter what, they want to go and play.
And are they on the ice just about year-round, both for recreation and the competition? I know that there is not ice in the arena in summer,
yes.
But there is most of the rest of the year.
Yeah, usually there's a group that comes from out of state for a camp when the ice first opens, and it's a week-long camp. And that's a great opportunity to sort of get started, to kickstart. And then there's preseason ice, which they're doing right now. And so, yeah, they're on the ice pretty much from August until the end of March.
keeps them busy. Yeah. Steve, the weekly Saturday introductory program that you mentioned is $99, but this Discover Hockey that is occurring this Saturday for a couple hours, is that free?
And that's free.
What age group is invited to come and put their toe on the ice?
It's ages 4 to 18. Most of the kids who come for this, I would say, are ages 4 to 8. But it doesn't stop at 8. And it is for 2 hours, from 3 to 5. Treadwell Ice Arena donated the first hour to us, and they've been doing that for several years now, and we are tremendously grateful. That extra hour makes a big difference in the kids having fun. The gear that we provide, a lot of the gear we purchase through a youth activity grant that the city's Parks and Rec Department puts forward. And again, without the city's help, the program I don't think would be quite as strong as it is now. We're very grateful for it. The youth activity grant that comes from Parks and Rec, that money goes right to the kids. But from there, it goes back into the arena, a public asset. And that arena is a tremendous public asset, not just to the kids playing hockey, adults play hockey, and then kids and adults enjoy figure skating there too. So,
how many kids in Juneau, say, from age 4 to 18, are involved in the Ice Association? How many youth are on the ice, would you say?
Last year, we had 220 of all ages and skill levels.
And how many, what percentage were girls, would you say?
We started last year, for the first year, a girls program.
Meaning a little girls program?
No, all ages.
All ages, okay.
And it just, as much as they are comfortable playing co-ed, they also like playing among their peers.
Sure, at least to get started and grow, I would guess.
And some of them actually came back to play hockey because they prefer playing on the girls' format. And so we had about, please don't hold me to the specific number, I think it was about 28 to 30. But not all of the girls did the girls program, so you might add another 10. So we might have about 35 girls. And again, some of them are very, very good. One of the girls goes to high school in New England because she's academically inclined and also a very good hockey player. Another one of our girl players we'll be playing for a team in Anchorage, a girls-only team that is a very high-level skilled team.
So you're kind of emphasizing the competitive nature of hockey, and it is a sport where two sides are competing. For kids who are a little bit shy about that or parents who are worried about putting their kids into a pressure situation, what would you say to those parents, particularly those who might be considering this, you know, opportunity to just check it out on Saturday?
Before every game that these kids play, and they play more games as they get older, the first thing I've always heard the head coaches say is, have fun. And that is stressed throughout the entire season, is to have fun.
And Kim, have you seen that with your sons?
Yes, very much. You know, they are competitive, but they have fun doing it. And I think the other thing that is nice about hockey is that, and a lot of people may not realize this, but hockey is a contact sport, but not until you're 14. So in terms of younger kids being on the ice, they're not exposed to that contact that some other sports have. And you know, so you just don't, that's not really an issue that you have to be thinking about until they're bigger, stronger, you know, older, mature, that can handle that sort of thing.
Steve, for the younger kids who might show up on Saturday, say those closest to, although the age range is pretty narrow, as you mentioned, ages 4 to 8, what is the first thing that you want them to learn? Ice skates aren't the easiest thing to stand up on, much less, you know, maneuver and throw a stick around. So what should parents or caregivers expect if they bring their little ones there on Saturday?
I think they'll see that the adults and then the student coaches that are out there are having fun with them. And so I think that's one of the first things we want them to see is how much fun it is to be on the ice.
And will they get assistance just balancing and learning a few steps to know how to stay upright on skates, or should a child already have been on ice skates to show up?
This can be their first time on skates, and we'll make it fun for them.
So I have this. If I have this right, there is no charge. The gear is provided.
The gear is provided.
It's open and free Saturday from 3 to 5.
From 3 to 5. But we also have... for people who are in the program, we've got gear, we call it a gear swap. So people will bring their gear, and they might need a pair of skates for their kids a half size up from last year.
Of course.
So we've got that. But we also have, for if a family decides, you know what, we want my kid in the introductory program, and they can get the gear from us for the loaner in the bag, but they might need skates. So the gear swap might have skates for the kids, too.
So the gear swap will be happening at
the
same
time in one
so
of the locker rooms.
So whether a family is bringing a child that afternoon or not, if you're interested in hockey, it's good to show up and see what's happening with the gear swap.
Sure.
If you need to trade in and trade up.
So they're going to run at the same time. So it's going to be a very, very...
It's going to be a busy afternoon over there.
It's going to be a very busy afternoon. If you've never been there, you're going to be amazed on how busy it is, both on the ice and off the ice. There's people also... that will help the families get the gear on the kids. So if the parents have never put hockey gear on themselves or on kids before, there will be plenty of people to help them with skates and the shin guards and everything else.
We're talking with Steve Quinn and Kim Dostal. They are board members of the Juneau Douglas Ice Association. And this Saturday, which is September 2nd, from 3 to 5 at the rink, Discover Hockey will be happening, and it's free, and there will be gear, and there will be trained adults and teen coaches to help your child, ages 4 to 18, get into the gear and get onto the ice. And after that, there are weekly Saturday morning sessions. It sounds like there's almost no reason for a family not to try hockey.
There's a lot of good reasons for them to try hockey and stay with hockey. There really are.
Well, we're lucky to have the arena here. I know it took a huge community effort. And thank you for your work on the board and for coming to share that with us today.
Thanks for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 29th of August, 2017. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Love is the master key that opens the gates of happiness, of hatred, of jealousy, and most easily of all, the gate of fear. How terrible is the one fact of beauty." That was Oliver Wendell Holmes, the poet and the physician, born in Cambridge in 1809, a friend of Emerson's, of Longfellow's, other Boston intellectuals, who helped to found the Atlantic Monthly magazine in 1857. And it was Holmes who came up with the name, famous for his poem, Old Ironsides, and also for his collection of essays, The Poet at the Breakfast Table, in which he wrote, "We are all tattooed in our cradles with the beliefs of our tribe. The record may seem superficial, but it is indelible." It was his son who was the Supreme Court Justice. This was Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who said, "Insanity is often the logic of an accurate mind overtasked. Good mental machinery ought to break its own wheels and levers if anything is thrust among them suddenly, which tends to stop them or reverse their motion. A weak mind does not accumulate force enough to hurt itself. Stupidity often saves a man from going mad." It's the birthday of the man who said, "The actions of men are the best interpreters of their thought," John Locke, the philosopher, born in Somerset, England, 1632, who believed that all knowledge is derived from the senses and that we can know about morality with the same precision that we know about math, because we create our ideas. His essay concerning human understanding, published in 1688, a big hit all across Europe. It's the birthday of Karen Hess, born Baltimore, 1952, author of books for young adults. She married, she had two children, worked her way through a whole array of jobs, waitress and nanny and typesetter, proofreader, substitute teacher, book reviewer. Kept writing, published her first book in 1991, Wish on a Unicorn, and then in 1998, Out of the Dust, the story of a girl living through the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. It won the Newbery Medal and the Scott Odell Award in 1998. Here's a poem by Emma Lazarus, Long Island Sound. I see it as it looked one afternoon in August, by a fresh, soft breeze o'erblown, the swiftness of the tide, the light thereon, a far-off sail, white as a crescent moon, the shining waters with pale currents strewn, the quiet fishing smacks, the eastern cove, the semicircle of its dark green grove, the luminous grasses, and the merry sun in the grave sky, the sparkle far and wide, laughter of unseen children, cheerful chirp of crickets, and low lisp of rippling tide, light summer clouds, fantastical as sleep, changing unnoted while I gazed thereon, all these fair sounds and sights I made my own. Long Island Sound, a poem by Emma Lazarus. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Magoosh, online test prep for the ACT, SAT, GMAT, GRE, LSAT, and MCAT. Prep smart, go far, and enjoy the ride at magoosh.com. And by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Years ago, the first barrel of oil flowed down the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, it goes, shh, and I just woke up and I went, oil's in.
Midnight Oil is a new series and podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk about the pipeline that shaped the state. Visit ktoo.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. Lineage, Tlingit Art Across Generations, premieres tonight on 360 North. The one-hour documentary film is a collaboration between KTOO Public Media, 360 North Public Television, and Tlingit poet and storyteller Ishmael Hope. KTOO and 360 North Scott Burton co-directed the documentary, and he brings us this preview.
And so, like. So now you can move this over a little bit. See how it has a ripple there?
Okay.
If you put that back on there and hit right there, it's going to take that ripple right out of it.
That's Donald Gregory showing Ishmael Hope how to make tana, or copper shields. Gregory is among the artists featured in the documentary, which explores the artistic lineage of many Tlingit culture bearers, including weavers, carvers, bead artists, musicians, and more. Tlingit poet and storyteller Ishmael Hope co-directed the film.
What was important to me was a multi-generational revelation of how the spirit of Tlingit art gets fostered, how it continues, how it gets reincarnated.
One of our first shoots was with culture bearer and carver Paul Marks.
When we dance, it does something to our spirit. It makes us feel good. And to wear our ancestral atu brings us strength and pride in our people, of our ancestors.
To see the art in action, Hope organized a kawik, or potlatch, in Sitka.
Oh,
that I love the most is when we're seeing the people in the regalia, in their at'u, their chilcap blankets and the clan hats, those heavy, important clan hats, they're dancing in that. The culture is fully alive, and everyone in that room feels it.
In Sitka, we filmed Master Weaver Terry Rothgar in our studio. Rothgar passed shortly after our visit. The scenes in the documentary are her last footage.
Well, you know, for me, the mountain goat and this spruce roots, you know, this was cutting edge science 6,000 years ago. And so for today, what are we doing? You know, if I want Tlingit methodology, if I want our weaving to be relevant 6,000 years from now, how am I going to make that possible? It's very obvious now that I'm the one passing through the weaving, not the weaving in me.
Fellow Master Weaver Clarissa Rizal also passed after our time with her. Beyond footage of her working with her daughter, Lily Hope, she left us with knowledge like this.
This is a spiritual practice for women. When you raise up the spiritual practice of a woman, you raise up the level of harmonious existence.
We also spoke with multidisciplinary artists, brothers Nick and Jared Glannon, as they carved a canoe in Sitka. They're the grandchildren of master carver George Benson. Here's Jared on Tlingit Art.
Working on this canoe by making artwork and studying that and diving into that and actively engaging it has become the best way to feel some ownership towards it and, I guess, belonging to it.
Jared's brother Nick and his music project, Silver Jackson, provided the documentary's music. Songs like this one called Perfect Mistake.
You tell me that it's wrong. You tell me that it's wrong. I know that you were right, but I just want it all. And you and I are flawed.
If Hope regrets anything with the film, it's that we didn't cover more artists.
You know, so this is a sampling, and hopefully it has enough range to reveal some of this vision and these questions we were going for regarding the generations, regarding the spirit and character of the art.
In Juneau, I'm Scott Burton.
Lineage Tlingit Art Across Generation premieres tonight at 8 p.m. at 360 North and at 360north.org. With me in the studio now is producer Scott Burton and KTOO Arts and Cultural Director Cheryl Snyder. Thanks for popping in today and talking about this production. It sounds beautiful just listening to it, the radio version, and to know that you captured the voices and were able to put on film the skills of at least two amazing women who have carried on skills that have been those, as Terry said, of a tradition more than 6,000 years old.
Yeah, you know, it was just one of those happenstances in setting out to do this project. It's actually, the project has been in the work for a couple years, and they were always part of our storyline. But to have both of them pass away right after we had recorded them in the fall really ended up underscoring what the whole point of the film was, is that these beautiful Tlingit traditions get passed down from one generation to the next. In particular, with Clarissa's passing, her daughter Lily Hope really has taken on her, you know, that matrilineal lineage of teaching and weaving and, you know, bringing up that next generation.
When I first heard and saw, as I was here at KTOO, the work being done with Ishmael to produce this piece, the first thought I had was, hasn't this already been documented?
Right, right. And speaking for Ishmael, he wishes he was here, by the way, right now. He's teaching out at the university. It's the first week of classes, so he's really, really busy. But, you know, according to Ishmael, maybe not. And getting this real sort of grassroots, community-centric look at what Tlingit art is was very, I know, important to him.
Ishmael says at the end of this radio piece that his disappointment was that more artists were not featured. How many total artists are going to be in this evening's documentary? Do you have a sense of that, Scott?
You know, I was just working on the website, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, at least 12, and there are more that just sort of happen peripherally through the film, but I would say 12 that we meet and talk to. And I would echo that sentiment of Ishmael's. He was constantly talking about, you know, there's so many great Tlingit artists and Northwest Coast artists here in our community. And he wanted to spend time with so many of them, but in 1 hour. If you do that, you get sort of a very topical look, right, at art and these individuals. He chose to take this perspective, which I think gives us a more detailed look, a more in-depth look at this, these selected artists.
Yeah, and I'll say, just to kind of clarify, like, this perspective that Scott is talking about, it's really a personal story. Ishmael's wife Lily is featured. His mother-in-law Clarissa is featured. And because of these relationships that Ishmael has with the people that we meet, there's just it just creates such an engaging story, because there's so much genuine warmth and connection that really comes across in the telling of this story.
As non-Native people, each of you take a moment to describe what you learned that most resonated with you as kind of an outsider looking in.
Oh, good question. Yeah. Well, I felt really honored to be able to, you know, go to the Potlatch or Kulik in Sitka and see that firsthand and film that and sit in the living room with Nora Marks-Dauenhauer and watch her read the Jesse Dalton poem that's featured in the piece. Hang out with Paul Marx, a culture bearer, and listen to, you know, all of his wisdom. He's such a dynamic person and knows the culture so well. And Ishmael, I think I can say this for him, you know, Paul was sort of a guide in this film. We would go see Paul, and Paul would give us advice about Tlingit art, and, you know, he's a great carver and culture bearer, and we'd get sort of advice and then go out and look for this person or look for this thing, you know, like a Kulik. And so we got to spend time with some people that I never would get to spend time with, and it was really enlightening.
Yeah, I really echo everything that Scott just said. I think for me, you know, I've been working for this organization for 20 years. I've had the opportunity to work on a lot of different cool, interesting projects, but this really is at the top of, like, my most favorite, most meaningful. And it's part of what Scott just described. I think, you know, Paul in particular, I was there for a couple of the days that we were recording with him, having conversations with Ishmael. And you'll see in the film, he just has so many beautiful things to say and explains so much about the meaning and the spirit behind every part of Tlingit practice. That was just really revelatory for me. And learning about the atu, the sacred objects that are created. Yeah, I mean, all of that. I think there's just so much in the film that was new for me and deeply meaningful.
So I have listened to those who have different views of the status of Northwest Coast art, in particular that in Alaska. It certainly is one of the richest traditions in the world. Indigenous peoples here had a ready food supply, which allowed them to have time, thus to make their items extremely beautiful. They could spend time on art, whether it was a house screen or their hat or their basket or their boat. How did you feel watching this process at the end of the documentary about what the next steps are for the tradition of Alaska Native art? I've heard folks say youth don't have the respect or understanding, and I've heard others say, but the Renaissance is happening. Young people are picking it up. What did you see in your path as you produce this with Ishmael?
I would defer to Ishmael. I don't really feel comfortable answering that.
Yeah, I think that's. I think I'm going to also defer to Ishmael, but I will say that one of the main points of the film is that that native spirit, that Tlingit spirit, is very much still alive today, and it's living and it's being passed down through generations. And you'll see in the film, yes, we speak with many elders, and then we have a range of artists that we're looking at who are in their 20s, and we see some children, and they're the ones who are going to get trained up and are not trained but taught this culture. So I don't want to speak for Ishmael, but I think the whole point of what this film is about is that this spirit is alive and here today.
Do you think it's a film that would be apropos for pretty much any age group? Meaning, could a young child gain something from watching this?
Absolutely. I've got a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old who are going to watch it with me tonight, and I know that they will appreciate it. There's the music to the film is all by Silver Jackson.
We heard a little bit about it.
It was quite beautiful. It's gorgeous. It wasn't created for the film, but it's, of course, created by a Tlingit artist, and I think because he creates from this place, it so perfectly matches what we created. You know, when we paired it, it was just like magic. So there's great music to it. There's great visuals of art. There's this is not a heavy documentary. It's got a lot of light and life and joy and personality in it. So, yeah, my kids are going to watch it. And I think, any age going up, it's for broad audiences.
And did Ishmael come to the station and ask you to consider this production? How did it germinate?
So it started about 2 years ago. Scott and I are two of four parts of our arts and culture team, and we were talking about wanting to do a film project and specifically do something with Tlingit culture, but neither Scott nor I are of that heritage, so it was real obvious that we couldn't tell the story. I reached out to Ishmael, and we got together with him, and let him kind of shape what the story should be, and we put a proposal together to the Alaska Humanities Forum, and we ended up getting, our grant got funded, so that was terrific news. And from there, K2 put in a bunch of its resources, and we were able to proceed making this film.
We're talking with Cheryl Snyder and Scott Burton of the Arts and Culture Production Team here at KTOO. And they worked with local culture bearer. He's just about a culture bearer, Ishmael Hope. He's perhaps a little young to claim that title, but he has been such a proponent for so many years about the culture and the art of our community and of the region as well. And tonight, Lineage, Tlingit Art Across Generations, will premiere at 8 o'clock on 360 North, and you can find it on demand at 360North.com. Thanks for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, Lori.
Today, BirdNote looks in on Garrison Keillor's mythical Lake Wobegon. It was sunny and nice in Mist County this week, but it was quiet. The loons, nesting out on Lake Wobegon, gave those eerie, unforgettable calls all summer long. People out in their boats stopped and listened when they heard those loons, pulled their oars right out of the water. The loons have finished nesting and gone quiet. Their fledglings, of course, were all above average. And purple martins nesting in the big box on the pole outside the Chatterbox Cafe? Well, they've been chirping happily out there since May. They pulled out last weekend, headed for South America. Even the orchard orioles in the tree in back of the sidetrack tap. Gone south. Quiet. Sadly, they're gone. But birding at the lake is still pretty good. The cardinals aren't going anywhere. Neither are the chickadees. Lake Wobegon may be a myth, but you can actually walk on the Lake Wobegon Trail. Yep, it's for real. Find it or a public land near you when you begin at our website. And in September, we invite you to celebrate National Public Lands Day. Begin at birdnote.org.
This station receives support from Canyon Hydro, providing components, maintenance, inspection, and repair services to remote hydro producers with fly-in service available. Information about these services can be found at canyonhydro.com.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. This is Lori Scandling with you for the rest of our program. Right now, my guest is Juno School's Student Services Director, Bridget Weiss, and we're going to talk about the new Kinder Ready Preschool at Harborview School. Glad to have you here, Bridget. Student Services is a huge job within the Juno School District, I know. How is Kinder Ready Preschool different from anything that the district may already have or have had in the past?
The district has several preschool opportunities for kids. One is our children's house at Montessori that is a full-day program. The other is our integrated preschool program where we serve students with special needs and have some peer tutors in that same classroom. Kinder Ready is really just a third option. It is for four-year-olds only. It is funded through a state grant, currently only being housed at Harborview. But it is a great opportunity for families to choose a morning session or an afternoon session. And today was the first day with kids. So we just got started today. We're very excited about that.
And are there still spots in either the morning or the afternoon?
We actually have spots in both. We have partial classes right now in both sessions. So students still have the opportunity to pick which session they would like to do. The morning is from 8 until 11, and the afternoon session is 11:30 to 2:30.
And is there a charge? I assume there would not be if it's part of the public school district.
Well, actually, there is, because we're still, as a community, working on how we fund early childhood education, pre-elementary. And so, similar to the integrated preschool program where we have peer tutors and this Kinder Ready program, the charge is $200 a month. We also have the opportunity, because of the grant, that if a family has higher economic need but still would like to participate, we have the opportunity to be able to scholarship some families in. So if a family wants their four-year-old in our program, we would love to have them, and we will find a way to make that work. The general cost is $200 a month, but we do have some assistance for families that need it.
What about transportation? Sometimes that's a barrier. Most families live in the valley, not in town. Harborview's in town. I assume Harborview was probably chosen because it had space. Oftentimes it's driven
exactly
by space. But what about getting there?
Well, first of all, this is our first year of offering Kinder Ready, and we hope next year to be able to expand that, and our hope would be then that we would have a Valley location as well. So this is just our start of this program. Transportation is one of our most costly resources that we have. So unfortunately, the grant isn't large enough to provide transportation, at least this year at this point. So that is going to be an obstacle for some, for sure. We hope in the future to be able to find a way to have transportation provided and also to expand so that we have a Valley location and a town location. But it is important to note that any child anywhere in Juneau can attend Kinder Ready. They don't have to be a Harborview on the Harborview trajectory to apply. They absolutely can do that from anywhere in town.
I know that the school board recently had a retreat and that the early childhood pre-K readiness is their number one priority. I assume that's associated with the long-term research that shows benefits of that readiness at an early age. Talk about, Bridget, if you would, why the school district is headed in that direction. What do you know that you can share with the public?
Research is really clear about paying it forward and the economic impact of and the educational impact of starting early with kids. And this year, this four-year-old year prior to kindergarten, is a time in a child's life that is just critically important to them succeeding when they hit the K-12 system. So it really is all about a pay-it-forward kind of a system. And we hope that we can provide a quality program. We're planning on providing this quality program that really ensures that kindergarten readiness. It's very exciting in the community of Juneau because there's a lot of focus right now on early childhood and pre-kindergarten is one of the pieces of that. And I feel like Juneau as a community is really generating some momentum around figuring out as a community, how do we build a sustainable system so that we have high quality child care, high quality pre-kindergarten experiences, so every kid shows up ready for that kindergarten learning experience.
What will four-year-olds be learning? What are some of those key skills that are springboards into a successful K-12 experience?
One of the things that we did in our planning year last year was we surveyed parents and we did research. So we kind of blended those two pieces, what research says and what parents see as what that their children need. Many of those things are tied around social and emotional learning, the ability to communicate with their peers, to support structural transitions in a classroom, being really emotionally ready for the interactions and the learning opportunities. We intend to honor what the research says about play-based curriculum and ensuring that kids are learning through that avenue of play. One of the interesting requests that our parents strongly requested was outdoor time, which is, I think, a really comment on the community that we live in and the priority that most of us here feel in terms of just general health and well-being of being outdoors and exploring learning in the out-of-doors. So we're looking at some ways to be able to do that as well.
We're talking with Bridget Weiss. She is the Director of Student Services for the Juneau School District. And we're talking about the new Kinder Ready Preschool. It is housed at Harborview. It started today. There are two shifts, 8 to 11:30, and the second shift is 11:30 to 2. And
2:30.
And although it is $200 a month, it sounds like for families that may have some financial challenges, there may be some opportunities to still involve the kids in the Kinder Ready program. Transportation is not provided. Bridget, where can an interested caregiver find more information?
If you go to our main district webpage, junoschools.org, right in the center of the page, right under the school calendar, is a menu of things. Apply for preschool is one of them. And if you click on apply for preschool, there's some information. You click and the application is right there. The application for Kinder Ready and our integrated program are right there handy for you. And those applications can be turned in anywhere that's handy. They can be turned into any school, Harborview, district office. And we will get those applications. If they have questions, if parents or caregivers have questions that are specific to their situation, they can call 780-2072, and that will get them to Tracy. And Tracy can answer any of the logistical questions that families might have.
That's 780-2072. Bridget, thanks for sharing this information with us and describing the importance of Kinder readiness.
Thank you for having me.
It's summer, and Alaska Clean Harbors invites boating locals to help keep our waters clean and our wildlife healthy by using pump outs, scooping your pup's poop, and putting waste in its proper place. Find out more and get a free pump out adapter for your boat at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message brought to you with funding from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Clean Vessel Act through the Alaska Clean Water Actions Program.
with us on a Juno afternoon today. I'm Lori Scandling, and I'm pleased to welcome to our studio the six members of the Springman Family Band. And they are visiting Juno from Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm going to have each of them, starting with the smaller folks on the end, will you please introduce yourself and tell me your age?
My name's Sarah, and I'm 8.
Okay.
And my name's Jacob, and I'm 6.
I'm Ryan, and I'm 10.
Hi, I'm Emma. I'm 13.
I'm Daddy, and I'm not going to tell you how old I am.
Welcome, Papa. And my mom is here, too.
Yeah.
Just say that. So we have the Springman Family Band. What brings you to Juno?
Well, we've got great friends here. We were here last year, and they invited us to come and do a concert on Friday night at the Jack, and we said, sure, of course. And as you can tell, we came to do some fishing, too.
I see you have the appropriate boots on.
Right.
So let's see. Jacob and
Sarah,
what instruments do you play?
I'm starting to play ukulele,
and I play the shaker.
All right, who plays blues harmonica? Come on, someone has to.
No harmonica yet.
Oh, you have room for me in your band. Oh, wait, I don't know how to play that. Okay, tell me what you play.
I play the djembe. It's called the djembe. It's an African drum.
Oh, interesting.
And you hit it with your hands.
Okay, and?
I play the ukulele.
So we have two ukulele players, Sarah and Emma, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And I play ukulele and guitar.
All right, and Mom?
I don't play.
You're the coach.
I supervise.
You keep gas in the van and cookies on the table, probably.
Yep.
How did you come together as a family band?
Well, we came together as a family. That was easy enough. Well, maybe not easy, but I've been doing music for, 20-plus years, and as my kids started to get older and kind of see what I was doing, they wanted to be involved because they saw how much fun it was. And so I've recorded a number of albums on my own. But then just last year we recorded an album as a children's band.
And what time is the concert? You said it's Friday evening at the Jack. What time?
6 p.m.
6 p.m. And is there a charge for it?
There are a suggested donation of $5 per person or $20 per family.
And I'm wondering how you got here. Are you in a vehicle that you put on the ferry? Did you canoe up from British Columbia?
We swam. We're very hardy. And
you've got some good color in your face.
So. Yeah. Well, actually, we were just fishing today, and then we didn't catch anything, but that's another story. No, we flew up. We flew in last Saturday morning, actually, because we played a concert up in Vancouver area on Friday night, and then we drove down to Seattle and caught the first flight out Saturday morning, so we were quite tired. But we spent the weekend at Echo Ranch. We were there with Calvary Fellowship and their group. We had a great time.
So for Sarah and Jacob, tell me, each of you, what's the best thing about learning an instrument and what's the hardest thing? What do you like most about playing an instrument?
How quickly you can learn.
And you're playing the ukulele, is that right? And how about you, Jacob?
I think that just learning with my dad and stuff.
It's fun.
And is it Ryan? Is that Ryan?
Yeah.
Talk about those drums. Why drums? How'd that happen?
When I was about 2, I just started playing on a little toy drum, and then I just kept liking to play, so I kept playing. And then eventually when I was 4, I started playing with my dad on stage, and then eventually I just started playing in the band.
So you've been on stage since you were 4, Ryan. Do you ever get nervous?
Sometimes a little bit, but mostly you get used to it.
And Emma, how about you? Do you see yourself branching out into other instruments?
I don't know. Piano sounds fun, but I'm really enjoying the ukulele and also teaching Sarah how to play and teaching her rhythm and stuff. We have actions and dancing with the songs. And so you'll be seeing some of that if you come on Friday. You'll see some of the dancing, but Sarah and I do that together.
Some choreography happening. Huh? Do you have, Sarah, do you have special, like a dancing outfit, dancing shoes?
Sometimes.
She's kind of smiling. No, wait a minute. Hasn't school started down in B.C. yet?
We homeschool.
And have you always done that?
Yes.
Yeah,
my wife is the greatest teacher on earth.
So even though she says she doesn't play an instrument, she keeps the kids learning.
That's right.
Yeah, you couldn't do it if you didn't have a great teacher who's, because they bring stuff on the road, bring school books often on the road. Although on this trip we didn't, I think, because they've been doing kind of school work all summer too.
How would you describe your music?
Wow. We call it, it's been called children's music for grown-ups. And what we mean by that is that, have you listened to much children's music before?
Not recently.
Okay. Well, most children's music, because we've, with four kids, we've heard all of the children's music that you can imagine. And some of it's really, really awesome. Some of it, well, it's all really good. But some of it isn't really appealing to adults. And so when I wrote these songs, the producer and I got together and wrote these songs. We wanted music that adults were not going to be like, twice is enough. But that's just not the way it works when you're driving, doing a long drive. Because kids, if they like a song, they want to hear it like 10 times in a row. And after four or five times for most adults, you're like, you got to find something else. And so we specifically wrote songs that adults would kind of could appreciate on their level as well. Almost like a child looks at a sunset and looks at it and goes, ah, pretty. Whereas an adult might look at it and kind of see it in maybe in a higher, deeper way. I don't know, maybe not. And I think that's kind of what was behind it. We wanted the production to be really high. And so the producer on it, he's won four Grammys for music. Yes, it was amazing. His name's Mark Heimerman. And so he's well known. He's done some pretty amazing production. So that has made the biggest difference, is having a producer like that and who puts such detail into it. Doesn't accept, second best. It has to be right.
Where can listeners find your music? Is it on YouTube?
There's starting to be some on YouTube, but I mean, if you want to buy it, of course you can stream it. And in fact, we were just listening to a little bit of it on, what was that? Spotify, today. So it's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's on Google Play, it's, all the typical outlets.
And it's Springman Family.
Springman. Yeah, it's called the Springman. We're called the Springmans. The album is called Happy Beach, and you'll find it under my name, Perry Springman.
We're talking to the Springman Family Band because we're talking to the Springman family.
That's right.
That includes their papa as well as their younger children, Sarah and Jacob, and their older kids, Ryan and Emma, and their mom is the homeschool teacher. They will be performing tomorrow night at the Jack. Friday night at the Jack. Any other performance spots?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, welcome to Juneau.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll look forward to having you perform here in our community. Thanks for joining us today on a Juneau Afternoon. And tomorrow, Shelley Delaney will be your host.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 1.